The Russian Revolution of October 1917 really represents a high point of human achievement. It was the first time that the working class has destroyed the bourgeoisie as a class and centralised all of the state apparatus in its own hands, creating an unparalleled system of democracy and laying the basis for true human liberation. Yet, by a decade after the revolution, it was quite clear that something had gone or was going terribly wrong. Joseph Stalin had rose to the head of the ruling Communist Party and was presiding over, with the backing of an increasingly powerful bureaucracy, the strangling of the revolution. And one revolutionary of the times could say, "The Stalinist reaction meant the systematic hacking away of every finger of control the working class had over its state. The Soviets were eviscerated and finally wiped out formally by decree. The trade unions were converted into slave drivers, cracking the whip over the working class. Workers controlling the factories went a dozen years ago." This is written in 1940. "The people were forbidden to bear arms, even non-explosive weapons. The militia system gave way decisively to the army separated from the people. The communist youth were formally prohibited from participating in politics. The Communist Party was gutted. All the Bolsheviks in it broken in two, imprisoned, exiled, finally shot." And by 1938, Leon Trotsky, who was formerly a key leader of the revolution, organiser of the October insurrection, head of the Red Army, could write, "20 years after the revolution, the Soviet state has become the most centralised, despotic and bloodthirsty apparatus of coercion and compulsion." The working class had been absolutely ravaged throughout the country, and the party purges extended far beyond the party. Trotsky wrote that they penetrated into all spheres of social life without exception. "Poets, astronomers, pedagogues and musicians, and therewith the best heads come under the muzzle of revolvers. Types of exploitation," he said, "which would not be countenanced in bourgeois democracy were running rampant, including millions of people by the 1930s in slave labour camps. An internal passport system which severely restricted freedom of movement and basic democratic rights was introduced. Prohibition of strikes under penalty of death was formally enshrined in law. Increasing labour productivity was associated with declining real wages. Women pushed back into the home, abortion criminalised. And the foreign policy of the Soviet state degenerated from one of promoting world revolution into one of rapprochement with the world bourgeoisie and the selling out of the world working class." So Stalinist Russia was clearly not socialist. So what then was it? Now this is an important question. The question of Russia and its nature has shaped the revolutionary movement throughout the 20th century and remains valid today in terms of the question of what sort of society we're fighting for, and it informs the strategy and tactics that are involved in such a fight against the system today. There have been three main competing explanations among the revolutionary left. The first was put forward by Trotsky himself. He argued that Russia was neither capitalist nor socialist, but in transition between the two. The second that we'll look at today was one put forward by, among others, Max Shachtman, who agreed that Soviet Russia was neither capitalist nor socialist, but argued that it was not on a transition between the two, but rather it was a new form of class society. And the third, which was argued by, among others, Tony Cliff, was that there had been capitalist restoration in Russia. So, to start with Trotsky, Trotsky was the key critic of the degeneration of Soviet society and the degeneration of the Bolshevik Party. He, along with hundreds of thousands of others, fought bitterly against the reaction that was occurring in the country during the 1920s and ultimately paid with his life for that fight. Yet, for all the pitfalls of Soviet society and for all the crimes of the bureaucracy, Trotsky maintained that Russia was a step forward for humanity. And until his death at the hands of Stalin's assassins in 1940, he maintained that Russia was indeed a workers' state. Now, the question of the precise nature of the state, we'll see, is all important for this debate. A state at a base level is a set of institutions which sits above society and is used to maintain the rule of one class over another. It's an institution or a set of institutions of violence, coercion and oppression. But after a socialist revolution, where workers put themselves into the seat of the ruling class and immediately begin dissolving class divisions, a state should start to wither away or die away. With the advent of a classless society, the main social antagonisms in society disappear, and the need for a state also disappears along with them. After the Russian Revolution, however, there were huge obstacles to the dying away of the state. And Trotsky noted that from the beginning, the new worker state had a dual character. On the one hand, it had a socialist character. The state consisted of a complex of institutions of workers' power that had expropriated the bourgeoisie and placed industry into its own hands. And to quickly mention, using the word bourgeoisie, which is not something is generally necessary to do. The capitalist class is usually something that's explicable enough, and we don't usually need to use French words for it. But it is important, we'll see later in the talk, it's important to make a distinction between the bourgeoisie, which is the class of individual property-owning capitalists, and the capitalist class per se, because one of the arguments we're going to be confronted with is that while the bourgeoisie is capitalist, a capitalist class does not necessarily have to be bourgeoisie, i.e. individual property-owning capitalist. So, on the one hand, the state has a socialist character, and Trotsky said, "The socialist character of industry is determined and secured in a decisive measure by the role of the party, the voluntary internal cohesion of the workers' vanguard, and conscious discipline of the administrators, trade union functionaries, members of the shop, nuclei, etc." On the other hand, he says, the state also has a bourgeois character. Because Russia had a very low level of industrial development, society was plagued by material scarcity. And as a result, the state had to play a role in administering the distribution of products according to bourgeois norms. And this inevitably led to a bureaucratic stratum rising above society. So Trotsky wrote, again, this is 1936. "The basis of bureaucratic rule is the poverty of society in objects of consumption, with the resulting struggle of each against all. When there are enough goods in a store, the purchasers can come whenever they want to. When there are little goods, the purchasers are compelled to stand in a line. When the lines are very long, it's necessary to appoint a policeman to keep order. Such is the starting point of the power of the Soviet bureaucracy. It knows who is to get something and who has to wait." So the bureaucracy, according to Trotsky, which rose above the revolution to a position of high privilege, was on one level the inevitable result of having a revolution in a backward country with no material support from the advanced economies. And notwithstanding the fact that Russia, for the first period of its existence, was subject to a stampede, I guess, of the world ruling class, the problem of the revolution becomes clear. So long as there is material scarcity, there will continue to be a bureaucracy as police force, and therefore the state will continue to be distorted. This was to be overcome, however, through the process of world revolution. When you get world revolution, the isolation of Russia does not become an issue. They get material support from the advanced powers, and scarcity is overcome. The problem was, however, that as the prospect of world revolution faded with the defeat of the German Revolution in 1923, and then in particular with the failure of the Chinese Revolution in 1927, the bureaucratic distortions of the state were getting worse. So the state was growing, not dying, and its strength grew in proportion as the growth in the subjection of the mass of the working class proceeded. Yet for all the material inequality and the privileges of the bureaucrats in Russian society, Trotsky maintained that the bureaucracy did not constitute a new ruling class. For it to be a new ruling class, he argued, it would have to establish new forms of property, whereas in fact it had an interest in maintaining the existing state form of property, or at least it was pressured to do so by the working class, he argued. But this question of state form of property became the key criterion for Trotsky when it came to talking about the character of the state. So he says now in 1931, "The character of the social regime is determined first of all by property relations. The nationalisation of land, of the means of industrial production and exchange with the monopoly of foreign trade in the hands of the state, constitutes the basis of the social order in the USSR. By these property relations is determined for us the nature of the Soviet Union as
a worker state.
So paradoxically, really, he's maintaining that the working class in Russia, despite the strangulation of democracy and despite the strangulation of criticism, despite the total loss of political power, was, in his words, the dominating class, simply because industry was in the hands of the state. And here we see, also as a side note, that he's changed his position. The original quote, which was from 1928, was a worker state is characterised by the capacity of the workers to discipline the bureaucracy and to use their instruments, the institutions of workers' power, to assert themselves over society and the economy as a whole. Now he's saying state-run industry is the determinant of a worker state. Now, for Trotsky, bureaucracy was not a class, but a caste. Now, what's the basis of his judgment here? A caste being just, it can be a section which has different elements of different classes within it, or it can be a particular section of a class which has certain privileges, but is not a different complete social layer in and of itself. So classes are defined by their relationship to the means of production, not distribution. So your class position isn't defined by your level of wages or the things you consume. Rather, your class position is defined by your relationship to the productive apparatus of society. Trotsky was adamant that the bureaucracy was not a new ruling class because it didn't have formal ownership over the productive apparatus. So he says, from the point of view of property in the means of production, the differences between a marshal and a servant girl, between the head of a trust and a day labourer, between the son of a people's commissar and a homeless child, seem not to exist at all. That is, he's saying, if you look at anybody in Russian society, not one of them can lay claim to ownership over any section of the means of production. Therefore, everybody has effective ownership. Yet the bureaucracy, despite this, still sat above society and was caught somewhat, Trotsky argued, in a balancing act between the workers on one side and the possibility of capitalist restoration at the hands of resurgent bourgeoisie on the other. So he says, two opposite tendencies are growing up out of the depth of the Soviet regime. To the extent that the regime develops the productive forces, it is preparing the economic basis of socialism. To the extent that, for the benefit of an upper stratum, it carries to more and more extreme expression bourgeois norms of distribution, it is preparing a capitalist restoration. So it's an unstable situation, he argues, and he uses the analogy of a pyramid standing on its head that can be pushed either way, and this is the real danger. But what had happened then in Russia wasn't that the revolution had been defeated, but that it had been betrayed, and it had been betrayed by a section of the ruling Communist Party which was increasingly fusing with a section of the state bureaucracy and who made decisions not on the basis of how to further the cause of world revolution, but on the basis of what was in their own narrow material interests. So for Trotsky, the problem in Russia was primarily a political problem rather than an economic one. And the argument, I think, seems plausible. If you think, under capitalism, the bourgeoisie doesn't actually rule directly. It's a separation of economic and political power. They maintain their social rule because of their control of the means of production. They're economically ascendant in that sense. In fact, as a class, they are, as American Marxist Howard Draper put it, unfit to rule in the political sense. That's because they're constantly at war with each other through their economic competition. And they are, as capitalists, necessarily short-sighted and bound to their own sectional private concerns. They don't trust each other to run the state. They usually, and of course there are exceptions, you don't want to overstate this dramatically, and you can think of Berlusconi in Italy being one in particular, or you know, some of the intermingling of the US state and sections of capital there. But usually they hand over the keys of government to an alien class force. So lawyers of the middle class, former trade union bureaucrats, sections of the military, or parties which, while not composed of individual capitalists, are committed to the running of the system as a whole. And it hands over the keys to those with a vision that can extend beyond the horizon of the next business deal. So you think in Australia, it's almost inconceivable that you'll get a finance minister who had $200,000 worth of shares in a major bank. And anybody that goes into politics generally has to vest their interests in particular capitalist concerns and disclose all their interests because the capitalists do not trust each other. So, you know, if you're industry minister and you're on the board of Ford, the capitalists at General Motors are going to get a bit toey about what's going to, you know, what favours you're going to give. Now, with this in mind, in the Russian context, Trotsky makes a point that I think seems quite convincing. He says basically that, one, the bourgeoisie has been expropriated by a genuine workers' revolution. That's true. Two, all industry has been centralised in the hands of the workers' state. Well, that's true. Three, through the decimation of the working class, through the civil war, the undermining of democracy, a bureaucracy has come to take over political power and run the state apparatus. That's true. So his conclusion then is to say the workers have been politically expropriated, but the fundamental gain of the revolution remains, a collectivised property form. So Trotsky's asking a question. He says, well, if workers today have to launch, not today, but back then, if workers then had to launch another revolution, what would be their task? And he says, well, industry's already state-controlled, so the only question is a question of who controls the state. There's no fundamental economic question. So workers need a political revolution to overthrow the bureaucracy, restore democratic control of the state and its institutions. However, they don't need to have a complete social revolution. And you contrast this to the situation previously where there were economic questions, in particular the expropriation of the bourgeoisie and the political questions of all power to the Soviets. So many people, though, took issue with Trotsky's analysis, and not just the Stalinists. Another critic of the Soviet Union who was formally in agreement with Trotsky was Max Shachtman, who was born in Poland and immigrated to the United States. His position was that Trotsky was right to say that Russia was neither socialist nor capitalist, but wrong to say that it was a step forward from capitalism, and wrong to say it wasn't a new class society. Shachtman pointed out that the Russian Revolution set forth fusing economic and political power in the hands of the working class. Decisions of factory and foreign policy and the work of administering each were brought together in a great leap forward into the realm of genuine democracy. And because economic and political power became fused in the hands of the state, Shachtman argues that Trotsky has things upside down. Shachtman argues that political power is a determinant of the character of Russian society. And writing in the year of Trotsky's murder, 1940, he said, "The social rule of the working class cannot express itself in private ownership of capital, but only in its ownership of the state, in whose hands is concentrated all the decisive economic power. Hence, its social power lies in its political power. In bourgeois society, the two can be and are divorced. In the workers' state, they are inseparable." So Lenin said that politics is concentrated economics. You see now, in this situation, Shachtman's saying we're turning everything upside down and around about. He says, "Where the state becomes a repository of all the means of production and is in complete control of them, economy is for the first time subject to conscious control by those who have the state in their hands. In this sense, politics determines economics. The working class," he says, "acquires economic supremacy only after it has seized political power." So this is good stuff. Working class political power is a function of the development of working class consciousness. The degeneration of the revolution and its ultimate defeat goes hand in glove not with the changing of property forms, but with the destruction of working class control over the property itself. And I think this is Shachtman's most important contribution to the debate, because he decisively restores the role of working class agency into the question of what socialism actually is. A workers' state. The institutions of power, such as the Revolutionary Party, the trade unions, the workplace committees, the soldiers' committees or the militias, and, of course, the Soviets, is defined not by forms of organisation alone, but by the extent to which they are the practical expression of working class consciousness, the extent to which they can be a tool for the working class to assert their domination over the rest of society. So saying, as Trotsky did, that the working class can be the dominating class and still have been politically expropriated was a nonsense, Shachtman argued, through which the workers are reduced from a living class to a decorative adjective. The mistake Trotsky made, argued Shachman, was confusing and interchanging property forms and property relations. Yes, property in the hands of the state is collective property, but it isn't the collective property of all society, it's the property of those who control the state. So, he says in 1943, once the means of production, and this is a bit repetitive, but I'm hammering home the point, once the means of production and exchange have been made state property, the question, who is the ruling class, is resolved simply by answering the question, who rules politically? Yet, for Shachman, this new class wasn't a capitalist class. Ironically, he agreed with Trotsky on one point, given his criticisms of Trotsky that I just mentioned. He agreed with Trotsky on this point. Capitalist restoration could only come about through the counter-revolution of the bourgeoisie, not the bureaucracy. Capitalism, for both of them, meant private property. And you can't have capitalism with collectivized property. So he says, the Stalinist social system does not show any of the classic traditional distinctive characteristics of capitalism. And this is a good quote. There are as many embarrassments in conceiving of a capitalist state where all capitalists are in cemeteries or in emigration as in grasping the idea of a workers' state where all the workers are in slave camps or factory prisons. So he makes a very good argument, but it brings us on to the theory of Tony Clift, the theory of state capitalism. Because Clift joined the argument after the Second World War, and his starting point was the theoretical contradiction which arose once the practical fact of Soviet expansion into Eastern Europe had been accomplished. With the Russian army occupying half of Europe and the transformation of those states, East Germany, Hungary, Romania, etc., into mirror images of Soviet society, how were those states to be characterised? Well, Trotsky's by this time, he's been murdered, so he can't answer, but neither can his theory. Eastern Europe had not had a series of workers' revolutions, so surely these societies must still be capitalist. Yet, if they're identical to Russia, and Russia is a workers' state, then they must have been able to create a workers' state without having had a series of workers' revolutions. The fundamental principle of Marxism, then, the emancipation of the working class must be the act of the working class itself, is disproved. Hopefully, though, Shachman has convinced us that this was not a workers' state anyway. What Clift did was launch an argument against both Trotsky's followers and Shachman and others that a capitalist counter-revolution had occurred in Russia in the late 1920s. So Trotsky contradicted Marxism by holding that you can have a workers' state without workers' power. Shachman dealt with this, but he left his critique of Trotsky in the negative. He gave nothing other than a name to the sort of society it actually was. He didn't outline the dynamic of the system, the way exploitation operated, or the nature of the class struggle. It was, Clift argued, completely arbitrary to declare the society bureaucratic collectivist without putting forward a positive construction of how society actually operated. And further, if Russia was a new form of society, then Marxism could offer absolutely no perspective for the people who lived in this society. Marxism is a theory of working class revolution. And if this is a new class society, then, as Shachman and others did argue, the working class didn't exist. They were more like slaves. Well, if that's the case, then Marxism is irrelevant for everybody in these societies. So Shachman killed Marxism in order to save it. Clift undertook... Clift undertook a detailed study of the Russian economy. He argued that both Trotsky and Shachman confused property forms with property relations. Trotsky had said, well, the state owns the property, therefore it's a workers' state. Shachman said, property's collectivised, therefore it's not capitalist. Clift responded, and this is 1948, from the form of property alone, whether private, institutional, or state property, it is impossible to define the class character of a social system. For this, it is necessary to know the relation between people in the process of production, the relation between the toilers and the means of production. And using the example of the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, he argued, and this is a bit longer, the church had tremendous tracts of land on which hundreds of thousands of peasants laboured. The relations between the church and the peasants were the same feudal relations as existed between the feudal manor owner and his peasants. The church, as such, was feudal. At the same time, however, none of the bishops, cardinals, etc., had individual rights over feudal property. It is the relations to production which define the class character of the church property, which was feudal, notwithstanding the fact that it was not private. One and the same relations of production can be expressed in different forms of property, the one private, the other institutional. And this is one of Cliff's key breakthroughs, and the reason why at the beginning I made that distinction between talking about the bourgeoisie and the capitalists, because it's central to Cliff's argument. What you had in Russia was a definite series of class relations, argued Cliff. A minority who controlled the productive apparatus society, a majority who labored but had no control over that apparatus and no control over the products of their labor. He had a system of alienated labor, and importantly, Cliff identified, as did a number of others, that there was a wages system in operation in the Soviet Union. Shachtman had said, the Stalinist social system does not show any of the classic, traditional, distinctive characteristics of capitalism. Yes and no, says Cliff. If you look at the internal dynamics of Russia, it might have, notwithstanding this, the fact of wage labour, just the dynamics itself, looking at Russia in isolation, it can appear this is the case. Competition has been eradicated. All of the means of production are in the ownership of one body, the state. Commodity production appears to have disappeared. And for those who know much about economics, the argument is the law of value has ceased to operate. Cliff argued, however, that to understand Russia, you had to take the starting point of world economy. Russia could be seen, he argued, to act in the world economy as one state in the same way that a company acts in a national economy. So he argues that the bureaucracy was like management. You think management of a company, often, more so than not today, they sort of do because they've changed the way that they companies operate. But generally, management don't need to, or often don't, own a company that is producing profits and exploiting workers. Management oversee the exploitation of workers. They decide how profits are reinvested. They make decisions based on how they're going to best compete with other companies in the national economy. And they draw their own remuneration from the pool of the wealth that's generated by the workers in the company or in society as a whole. The bureaucracy, Cliff argued, likewise oversaw the exploitation of the Russian workers, and their decisions were based on the fact of international capitalist competition. In fact, Cliff argued, Russia wasn't completely unique in this respect. In most of the advanced economies, the workings of classical traditional capitalism, like free competition, distribution via price mechanisms, and freedom of labour, had become partially or fully negated by the advent of monopoly and the fusing of state and industry in the war economies. This didn't make any of those economies any less capitalist at all. It just meant that economic competition was becoming subordinated to military competition. And this argument was actually not particularly new, although when Cliff made it, it sort of was new, because he's resurrecting an argument that was made by somebody else who'd been buried by the revolution, and that was Nikolai Bukharin, who had argued during the First World War that the entire tendency of the capitalist system, as the concentration and centralisation of capital proceeded to new dimensions, was for the fusion of state and industry. State capitalism as a stage above monopoly capitalism. And I'm going to quote Bukharin here, because he makes the point quite clearly. He says, there finally comes a time when, he's talking about a national economy here, there finally comes a time when competition ceases in an entire branch of production. But the war for dividing up the surplus value becomes fiercer. The centralisation process proceeds apace. Combines in industry and banking syndicates unite the entire national production, which assumes the form of a company of companies, thus becoming a state capitalist trust. Competition reaches the highest, the last conceivable state of development. Competition is reduced to a minimum within the boundaries of national economies, only to flare up in colossal proportions between them. Now, there's an insight there which Cliff's drawing on. So on one hand, this does not happen in a capitalist society generally. That's one thing that Bukharin got wrong. Things did not proceed to that level of development when you had individual bourgeoisie. But in Russia, the situation was vastly different. The fundamental feature of capitalism, argued Cliff, was not private property, but the accumulation of capital. The subordination of consumption of the mass of the population to the expansion of industry under the coercion or the external coercion of competition. So when looked at from the standpoint of world economy, there are more similarities between Russia and the West than there are differences. It leaves the question, how exactly did capitalism become restored in Russia? Because this is perhaps one of the most confusing questions to deal with in understanding the nature of state capitalism. Trotsky argued again in 1936, he who asserts that the Soviet government has been changed gradually from proletarian to bourgeois is only, so to speak, running backwards the film of reformism. That is, Trotsky's saying, well, the entire premise of Marxism is if you go from one mode of production to another, it involves a massive struggle where you smash the state as they did in Russia and form a new state. If capitalism's been restored, why has there not been a smashing of the state in Russia? Why is it? How can you justify that without contradicting Marxism as a whole? But again, it comes back to the peculiar nature of the state in post-revolutionary Russia. The state under Soviet society was not just the instrument of one class oppressing another. Precisely because we had this fusion of political and economic power, the state had a double function. As Cliff said, one, a guardian of the ruling class, and two, the organiser of social production. So Cliff points out that where the bureaucracy of a worker state is transformed into a ruling class, economic and political restoration are indissolubly interwoven. The state becomes gradually further divorced from the workers. The relations between it and the workers become more and more like the relations between a capitalist employer and his workers. In such a case, the bureaucratic clique that first appears as a distortion gradually transforms itself into a class which fulfills the tasks of the bourgeoisie in capitalist relations of production, that is, developing the productive forces and the accumulation of capital. The gradual evolutionary divorcement of the bureaucracy from the control of the masses, which continued until 1928, reached the stage of a revolutionary qualitative change with the first five-year plan. So it's because of the dual function of the state that the bureaucracy could become capitalist under conditions of the pressure of world competition. But, contrary to Trotsky, this didn't require the smashing of the state. It required that the workers lost political power. And in fact, when you put two coincidental situations together, the workers losing political power and the bureaucracy, which something we haven't talked about, but the bureaucracy from 1928 smashes the peasantry, destroys the rich peasants and the resurgent rural bourgeoisie who'd been developing under the context of the new economic policy which had been instituted from 1921. The bureaucracy turns around and smashes them from 1928. So you have a situation where there is no possibility of bourgeois counter-revolution within the country, and there's no possibility of workers asserting their power because they've lost power and they've been half destroyed as a class. So on one level then, it becomes inevitable, in my opinion, it becomes inevitable that this direction then gets taken. The state was required to direct the development of industry. At the same time, the development of industry was prerequisite for the continued existence of the state, therefore of the bureaucracy also. The development of industry in Russia would have been impossible if it was subject to economic competition with the West, because it was so backward. It would have been economically smashed. So while competition was forced onto the bureaucracy, the competition immediately and necessarily took the form of military competition. Only with the development of a strong military could the Russian state defend its own industry, defend its monopoly of trade, and hold out the world bourgeoisie from encroaching on its territory. Ironically then, the process of defending Russia from the world bourgeoisie was actually the process of restoring capitalism in Russia. So the Cold War, then, which is portrayed as a simmering battle between two fundamentally different social systems, was simply an extension to the world stage of the struggle between what Marx had described as a band of hostile brothers, the capitalist class. Now to conclude. I said at the start that it's an important question and it shaped the revolutionary movement throughout the entire 20th century. But you can also think, well, what the hell does this have to do with anything now? Because Russia has now disintegrated. Well, I think there are a couple of things. Firstly, if we look before Russia, before the time of the Soviet disintegration, well, it was incredibly important that people had a clarified position on this. Anybody that held to Trotsky's position after the Second World War completely capitulated to Stalinism. If you thought that Russian society was a step forward for humanity, then at some point you had to defend its imperial onslaught in the parts of the world that it went into, or you had to defend it as a model of society that it should be aspired to, at the very least. For those that held Shachtman's position, well, plenty of people had different different political outlooks who held that position. So for some people, it didn't pose a huge obstacle to maintaining a revolutionary socialist position, precisely because Shachtman had restored the thing of revolution from below and workers' own self-activity. But Shachtman himself, as a number of others did, took the position that because it was neither capitalist nor socialist, but a new form of society where workers were treated worse than they were in the West, ended up taking a position that Stalinism was worse than capitalism. And he went on to argue that the Stalinists should be driven out of the workers' movement in the West, and then went on to defend Western imperialism against the Soviet Union as well, so backing the United States, which was a terrible mistake, but a logical conclusion on some level from a position of saying that this is worse than capitalism. But today, it still maintains its importance, partly because the question of Russia is still a touchstone for anybody who wants to change the world. The Russian Revolution of 1917, as we said, this is the first time that workers, and still to this day, the only time that workers have smashed the bourgeoisie in a country. It's been the biggest challenge to capitalism we'd ever seen. So anybody wanting to understand how to fight for a new world today has to come to grips with the questions of what happened in Russia and what Russian society was like. When we think about the sort of society that we want to see in the future, it makes an incredible difference as to whether somebody says they want to see socialism, i.e. society, where the state just nationalises all of industry and everybody still has to go on living their lives as cogs in the machine and exploited labour. That's a great difference from having a vision of society where the majority of people have political and economic power in their own hands. And that's the difference between, really, classic reformism and revolutionary politics. And you see that Trotsky actually slipped back into reformism with his characterisation of the state. Also then, though, today, it informs things like the question of strategy and tactics. When you look at the social movements that are going on around the world, the question of who you back and who you orient to, whether or not, regardless of what country you're in, who you orient to. Do you see workers themselves and ourselves, our own self-activity, as being the most important criterion for the development of humanity and for the foundation of a new society? Or do we see individual figures like the likes of Chavez in Venezuela or strong heads of state like Putin in Russia, which some people claim is falling back into socialism because of the nationalisation of industry? Like, do we view this as a step forward and the sort of vision that we have? Well, that informs how we orient in the struggles we're involved in day to day. Do we look for salvation from above, or do we look to our own power and the development of our power through our own institutions? And that's why I think it is important, and I'll leave it there.